control those, again, they can moderate the behavior of their opposition, including the United States.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Allow me to thank my guests, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, John Pfeffer, joining us from D.C. Also, thanks to National Security Analyst Brian Downing, joining us from Florida. Also, special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي وَاللَّهُ عَلَى كُلِّ شَيْءٍ قَدِيرٌ. يَوْمَ تَجِدُ كُلُّ نَفْسٍ مَا عَمِلَتْ مِنْ خَيْرٍ مُحْضَرًا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
North Korea hits out at the U.S. President's recent remarks about Pyongyang, warning Washington of a response to its hostile policies. Canadians stage a rally against COVID restrictions as similar protests in Sweden, Belgium, and Finland turn violent. A police in Turkey, Germany, and France arrest hundreds of ralliers marking International Labor Day. Hello everyone, welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zanjafik. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with North Korea, the country is warning the U.S. that it will face a very grave situation for sticking to more than half a century of hostile policy toward Pyongyang. North Korean Foreign Ministry said that the U.S. President Joe Biden made a big blunder after he called for diplomacy and stern deterrence against this country. The ministry called the talk of deterrence, veiled nuclear threat, and diplomacy a signboard for hostile acts. The Korean ministry said that this forces Pyongyang to take corresponding measures. In his Wednesday address to Congress, Biden said that North Korea's nukes pose a serious security threat. His press secretary, Jen Psaki, later called a complete denuclearization of North Korea. Pyongyang says its nuclear program is for self-defense amid the U.S. military's provocations on the Korean Peninsula. Now, Kim Do-shu, a senior fellow at the Pangol Institution, earlier joined us with his take on the latest row between the U.S. and North Korea.
It's really mostly up to the United States, you know, what kind of policy they are going to have toward North Korea. And then we would have the new kind of dynamics between the two countries and in the region. For example, the Trump administration pursued a grand bargain, UGC summit diplomacy between the two sides. A lot of people like that, but unfortunately, because of the hawkish, politicians inside the United States, their strong opposition, their sabotaging activity, so the summit failed. And then before that, you have Trump, you have the Obama. The Obama pursued strategic patience, basically doing very little. And now Biden says, basically, I'm going to pursue a policy in the middle ground between Obama and Trump. So we can see, you know, basically describe that as a normal diplomatic approach to talk to the North Korean side. But it's really about, you know, usually the U.S. Would, you know, put forward a lot of requirement, a lot of demands, you know, what the North Koreans should do, and then the U.S. will response, will react to their actions over there.
Tens of thousands of people have rallied in the Canadian city of Montreal to protest COVID restrictions imposed by the provincial government to curb a third wave of the pandemic there. Protesters held signs and chanted slogans expressing opposition to masks, curfews, and health protocols. They argued that restrictions imposed by the Quebec government are unjustified. Police made a number of arrests. The Quebec government had initially imposed curfews across Montreal, but said that the restrictions would be eased as of Monday due to the slowing rates of infections. Canada has recorded more than 1.2 million cases of coronavirus and some 24,000 deaths. That's more than half of them in Ontario and Quebec. Let's take a look at Europe. In Sweden, anti-lockdown protesters have taken to the streets of the capital of Stockholm, demanding a lifting of the country's COVID-19 restrictions. Police arrested several ralliers after they refused to disperse. Elsewhere in the Belgian capital, police used water cannon and tear gas to disperse protesters who defied social distancing rules. Hundreds of people also marched in central Brussels and through the eastern city of Liège, demanding a relaxation of coronavirus lockdown measures. Also in Finland, police arrested some 50 anti-lockdown demonstrators in Helsinki. Most European countries are facing a third wave of the pandemic as the EU and individual member states come under fire for slow vaccination rollout. We'll look at more of those protest news items. German police have clashed with ralliers taking to the streets to mark International Labor Day, also known as May Day, in the capital, Berlin. Protesters set garbage cans on fire and threw rocks and bottles at anti-riot police. Some officers used pepper spray against the crowd, while some others used water cannons to extinguish the fire. Several police officers were injured. Similar scuffles broke out in other European countries. In Turkey, more than 200 protesters were arrested in Istanbul. Turkish officials earlier allowed union workers to hold memorials to mark the annual holiday. However, they had warned against illegal gatherings in violation of coronavirus restrictions. Thousands of people also joined May Day rallies in Spain, the UK, and France. In Paris, police used tear gas to disperse the ralliers. French demonstrators in the capital and other cities mainly called for better working conditions, social and economic justice, as well as reform in unemployment benefits.
Over 300 marches took place and hundreds of thousands demonstrated all over France for May Day to claim more rights for the workers. The COVID crisis is hitting the French economy very hard, but not everybody is equally affected by the crisis. The 40 biggest French companies are doing very well despite the COVID crisis, but they prefer to pay benefits for their shareholders rather than improving working conditions. So the main concern for French trade unions now is to save jobs and to stop companies from firing workers.
The big companies have received a lot of public money without any social ecological conditions to fulfill. Public money cannot be given to companies that fire workers continue to pollute, companies that relocate. So we demand that strict conditions be imposed before giving public aid to companies.
The COVID crisis has highlighted the importance of ordinary workers for the French economy. Garbage collectors, railway workers, supermarket cashiers, mostly women, home care workers, delivery drivers, and, of course, hospital workers. Their work is now widely considered as essential to keep the economy running. French President Macron promised to re-evaluate their jobs.
Macron just promised a bonus that is not even obligatory. He does not want to increase the minimum wage, and that is for us to reference. The government thinks that the higher salaries will lead to less jobs, but for us it's the opposite. Higher salaries will boost the economy and create more jobs.
The demonstration in Paris was closely monitored by the police. Clashes broke out when more radical demonstrators threw stones and bottles to the police officers who charged and fired tear gas. There is a lot of frustration among working people. Many blame the French authorities for its disengagement from the public sector, especially the hospital sector, which is crucial to get the coronavirus under control. The anger is still growing among working people. Those at the front line against the coronavirus demand a permanent upgrade of their jobs, salary and working conditions. But the French government, till now, has only paid them bonuses once. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
Protesters have staged rallies to commemorate International Worker Day across the United States. Marchers saying that a coronavirus era is sharply increasing inequality and that poverty gives them even more reasons to demand their rights as workers. From Chicago, Rami Mazahedi reports.
Across the world, and even in the United States, people took to the streets to celebrate International Workers' Day, May 1st. The turbulent 2020 saw America reverse 50 years of political apathy. Marchers say the time for the lower and middle classes to unite is now, because the 1% is already united and profiting from soaring post-lockdown inequalities every day.
I do think that there will be a rise of leftism because, you know, when we're able to win certain gains through struggles like Black Lives Matter has, you know, getting Chauvin convicted, that shows the power of the working class to fight for more. And, you know, this is just the beginning of the mobilizations I think we're going to see.
Given the status of Chicago as the ideological center of neoliberal thought, many may be surprised that the epicenter of the very first May Day ever was Chicago. In 1886, 100,000 Chicagoan leftists peacefully took to the streets to demand an 8-hour working day and were met with deadly police violence. The U.S. government failed to replace May Day with an attempt at Law and Order Day, but by 1890, the first International Workers' Day for Unity and Solidarity was declared. The holiday is celebrated in scores of countries and often called Labor Day, but most English-language countries celebrate their own Labor Day in autumn.
This is a day where we're connecting lots of struggles that are important to the workers' movement, right? Immigrants' rights, the defunding the police, the Black Lives Matter explosion of the last year, right? The uprising has shown that there is really a fighting mood within the U.S., the workers' movement in general.
Many 19th-century struggles are still being fought today, such as against the privileges and parasitism created by monarchies. New U.S. President Joe Biden just rejected a $15 per hour minimum wage, even though wages haven't been hiked since 2009, and non-governmental estimates of inflation are 10% annually. Businesses like Amazon are dubbed innovation heroes in the mainstream media, yet are notorious for grueling working conditions. Many marching on May Day also oppose Western liberal democracy, which is often accused of creating and protecting a new aristocracy on the backs of the average worker. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
Now, in other news, the Yemeni army is saying it has conducted fresh retaliatory drone strikes in Saudi Arabia's southwestern province of Esir. Yemeni army spokesman Yahya Zaria said that the army successfully targeted King Khalid Air Base in Khamis Mashait with a cost of K-2 drones. He said that the attack was a response to the Saudi escalation of aggression and constant siege of Yemen. However, Riyadh said that its air defenses intercepted an explosives-laden drone. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015, and the aim was to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni fighters have stepped up retaliatory attacks against the kingdom in recent months. Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi says an agreement has been reached to remove most individuals and entities from the U.S. sanctions list, but major differences still remain, and progress is slow. From Vienna, where negotiations to save the Iran nuclear deal continue, Omar Lesky has a report.
another joint commission meeting among the remaining signatories of the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, comes to an end in Vienna. Iranian lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says an agreement has been reached to remove the majority of individuals and entities on the U.S. sanctions list, and that negotiations are continuing on the rest of the names on the list. Araghchi had mentioned earlier that the U.S. has also agreed to lift sanctions on Iran's energy, finance, insurance, automotive and shipping sectors. But Iran is demanding the removal of all U.S. sanctions imposed after the U.S. withdrawal from the deal in 2018, including those imposed under other labels by the Trump administration.
It's a very complicated issue, and as you know, sanctions have different categories, and we have to deal with all of them. Of course, what is our guiding principle is the firm positions taken by the Islamic Republic of Iran and has been emphasized by the Supreme Leader.
Iran has also steadfastly opposed a step-by-step process, saying it would only go back to full compliance after all U.S. sanctions are lifted and the Islamic Republic verifies their effective removal. Araghchi said delegates are now involved in the time-consuming process of drafting an agreement.
Now we have some texts available to us based on the negotiations we have already made, and now we are working on the words and phrases and sentences and paragraphs.
EU coordinator Enrique Mora said there were moderate advances, adding that with more detail comes more complexity. While the U.S. delegation led by Robert Malley has been engaged in negotiations in Vienna, there's been no direct talks between Iran and the U.S. Delegates have decided to have further consultations in their respective capitals before returning for another joint commission session here at the end of next week. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
Now we'll get some coronavirus news. The pandemic continues to wreak havoc across Europe, which accounts for roughly one-third of COVID cases and deaths worldwide. France has reported 195 new deaths in hospitals and over 25,000 new infections, and that raised the total cases to 5.6 million. Italy is the fourth largest in the world and Europe's largest caseload. Now, elsewhere in the continent, Italy reported another 226 deaths and 13,000 new infections. The country has 121,000 COVID fatalities, and it's the second highest death toll in Europe after the UK. In Germany, officials logged nearly 19,000 more cases, while fatalities rose by 232. Both figures were down from a day earlier. In Russia, authorities reported 9,200 new infections, bringing the total number of cases there to more than 4.8 million. In Brazil, officials have registered 67,000 new confirmed COVID cases, and that raises the country's total to more than 14.7 million. Health authorities also registered 2,600 new fatalities, pushing the toll to 406,000. Brazil remains the world's second worst hit by the pandemic in terms of fatalities. Meantime, supporters and opponents of President Jair Bolsonaro demonstrated in Sao Paulo amid the surging pandemic. Bolsonaro has been criticized for undermining the dangers of the virus, avoiding masks, and pushing unproven remedies. Elsewhere in Latin America, Mexico had more than 3,000 new confirmed cases and hundreds of more deaths. Total number of cases there are now exceeding 2.3 million and also more than 217,000 fatalities. Thousands of Colombians have taken to the streets for a fourth day to protest the government tax reform proposal. The proposed reforms would increase taxes on individuals and businesses and eliminate many exemptions. Unions and other groups are holding marches to demand the government of President Iván Duque withdraw the proposal. Four people have been killed in the rallies. Isolated looting, vandalism, and clashes between police and protesters have taken place in different cities. The protests continue despite the president's Friday announcement that the reforms would be revised. The government insists the changes are vital to stabilizing the country's finances, among other benefits. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah,
I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The month of God. In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful, Salam and welcome to the program. We are with you with another episode of the special series for Ramadan. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "The month of Ramadan is the month of forgiveness of sins and salvation from the divine punishment. It is the month of repentance and returning to God." Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, "Repentance and returning to God means returning from a wrong way, a wrong act, and wrong thought." When we say we return from a wrong way, it means to distinguish the wrong point and the wrong way. This is very important. The first step in repentance is to pay attention to the deficiency of the act, to understand where the falsity is, where our flaw is, and our guilt is. In the month of Ramadan, we should take as much care as we can to correct our behavior, our thoughts, our words, and our deed. We should find our defects and try to remove them. Dear listeners, repentance means returning from evil to good. It means firm resolve to give up sins. In other words, it means regretting the past acts. One should first clean the soul and heart from sins and then adorn them with divine merits. It is like taking off dirty clothes and wearing clean ones. Once Imam Ali, peace upon him, heard a man saying, "Astaghfirullah." It means, "I seek forgiveness with God." This phrase is usually uttered when pleading to God for forgiveness of sins. Imam Ali, peace upon him, told him, "Do you know what this phrase means? There are six conditions for istighfar, seeking forgiveness. First, regretting the sin. Second, serious decision not to repeat it. Third, paying the people's rights so that you meet God with no sins. Fourth, performing any obligation that you have not fulfilled so far. Fifth, trying to melt the flesh that has grown on your body with haram money so that your skin sticks your bone and fresh flesh grows. Sixth, cause your body taste the pain of worship, just as you caused it taste the sweetness of sin. Then you can say, Astaghfirullah." if a person cannot fast in Ramadan due to some problem and he does not compensate it till the next Ramadan, later on he should both fast for those days and pay atonement for them. As we have said earlier, the atonement for each day is 750 grams of wheat, rice, or dates, which should be given to the poor people. Dear friends, in Surah Fajr of the Noble Quran, God takes an oath by 10 nights. That is, Layal al-Ashr. Some exegetes say that these nights are the last 10 nights of the blessed month of Ramadan, which include the night of Qadr. These nights are very important to the extent that Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to stay at mosque during these nights for keeping vigilance and worship. He would recommend Muslims to revere these nights too. In view of this, i'tikaf, which means staying in mosque for worship and prayer, has been recommended for these nights. The Prophet said that i'tikaf during the last 10 days of the month of Ramadan has the reward of 2 Hajj and 2 Umrah, that is, minor Hajj pilgrimages. The acclaimed Muslim scholar, Sheikh Ya'qub Kolaini, has narrated from Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, as saying that during the last 10 days of the month of Ramadan, the faithful had better to recite this supplication while appealing to God. I seek refuge with the glory of your noble visage, lest the month of Ramadan passes by or the dawn of this night rises, while there has remained a sin or flaw with you, which you will punish me for it. It is also recommended to recite this supplication after the ritual prayers. O God, fulfill for us the rite of the month of Ramadan and forgive our shortcomings in it, and receive it from us while you accept it. And do not reprove us because of our extravagance on our souls, and place us among those who get your mercy, and do not place us among the deprived. Here is another supplication that is recited on the last 10 nights of Ramadan. O God, you have said in your book that you sent down the month of Ramadan. It is the month in which the Quran has been sent down as guidance for people and proofs of guidance and criterion. So, you revered the respect of this month by sending down the Quran in it, and specialized it by the night of Qadr, and made the night better than 1,000 months. O God, these were the days of the month of Ramadan that have passed, and its nights that have been lost. You know it better than me, so I ask you to bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, and separate me from the fire, and admit me to paradise, and answer my prayer, and show me favor to secure me on the day of fear from every horror that you have prepared for the resurrection. O softener of iron for David, peace upon him. O remover of grave trouble and grief from Job, peace upon him. O eliminator of Jacob's concern. O destroyer of Joseph's sorrow. Bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad as it behooves you to bless them, and treat me in a way that befits you, and do not treat me the way that befits me.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Early Thursday morning, a Syrian missile landed in close proximity to Israel's top-secret nuclear facility at Dimona in the Negev Desert. This comes in the wake of Israel attacking Iran's nuclear enrichment facility at Natanz. Was the timing of this just a coincidence, an errant missile, as Israel claims, or rather the indication of something much deeper? Let's take a closer look at what unfolded. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Early Thursday morning, reports began coming in through Israeli media of alarms and sirens going off near the Israeli nuclear reactor at Dimona in occupied Palestine. Within the hour, there were unconfirmed videos allegedly showing an explosion in the vicinity of Dimona from multiple angles. Although it wasn't clear exactly what this was, whether it was a target being struck or a missile being intercepted or simply blowing up midair. At the same time, there were also reports on social media from residents in Jerusalem and all over occupied Palestine of a large explosion being heard. Israeli media believed this to have been the sound of Israel's Patriot missile system being activated in response to a threat. Again, a lot of this was quite ambiguous at the time. It wasn't very clear what was happening. So let's go through the sequence of events and try to bring some clarity to this matter. So the very first thing that took place was that Israel attacked Syria. Israel proceeded to bomb targets in Dumer, which lies in the Damascus countryside, as well as targets in the occupied Golan Heights. A Syrian military source told the Syrian Arab news agency, Sana, that Israeli warplanes struck at 1:38 a.m. on Thursday, April 22nd. In response to that, Syria activated its anti-aircraft defense missile systems to counter the Israelis. As it did this, one of the surface-to-air missiles, or SAMs, that Syria launched apparently veered off target and went all the way into occupied Palestine, traveling some 200 kilometers and landing in close proximity to the nuclear reactor at Dimona, just some 30 kilometers away, completely unimpeded. Now, this facility is officially known as the Shimon Peres Negev Nuclear Research Center, and it's located in the Negev Desert, some 13 kilometers southeast of the city of Dimona. Now, shortly afterwards, Israel again launched a second round of airstrikes on Syria, returning to bomb some of Syria's anti-aircraft batteries. The Syrian military source told Sana that in total four soldiers were wounded, and there were some losses of equipment sustained as well. Now, this incident comes at a particularly sensitive time, barely 2 weeks, not even 11 days, after Israel secretly sabotaged Iran's own nuclear enrichment facility at Natanz. A spokesperson for the Israeli military insisted, however, that the Dimona nuclear facility was not the intended target of this Syrian missile and that it landed there by accident. Now, the Dimona facility is not home to just a nuclear reactor. It also houses something else. Joining me from Lebanon is Hadi Nasrallah, independent commentator and researcher. Thanks for taking the time, Hadi.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a bit more about this Dimona facility? You know, the Israelis say that it's just a nuclear reactor. How true is that?
Basically, I think the Dimona facility, I'm going to start with by saying that it always has been a pressure card in the hands of the actors of resistance, especially when it comes to resistance in Lebanon, Hezbollah. Said Nasrallah, in one of his speeches, he said that Lebanon holds a nuclear bomb. And then he later explained that statement, which was shocking for all of us at first, and then he said that our nuclear bomb, basically, in Lebanon is in Dimona. And he stated that Israel has a nuclear facility there, and if Israel continues its threat to Lebanon, the resistance is able to hit that facility, which can cause a lot of damage to Israel, or the occupied, basically, entity, occupation entity. And later on, Israel moved some of the substances and some of its reactors and nuclear chemicals. They moved them to another area, another region, and they moved them underground. It was all documented. So Israel claimed that it's not actually a nuclear reactor facility. It's not actually for nuclear bombs. If it wasn't that, then why were they so threatened by the words of Mr. Nasrallah at first? And of course, Israel didn't sign any deal internationally when it comes to nuclear weapons, so there's no way to finding out if Israel is actually saying the truth about not having nuclear bombs.
Everyone is fear-mongering about Iran having nuclear weapons, but we know for a fact that Israel has them. And as a matter of fact, some at this very facility in Dimona. What do you think of that double standard?
Well, basically, there were leaked emails before that Israel had 200 nuclear heads basically pointed towards Iran. And this didn't even shock anyone, and no one actually questioned that or talked about it. And then one false flag in Syria, you see all of these international organizations, all these countries condemning, and they want to get on the ground to investigate what few jihadists claim. But something as serious as that, when it comes to Dimona, you have Iraq state, Iraq entity, that literally caused a lot of chaos and devastation in the region, that there is a chance that such state can hold this amount of nuclear heads and that yet this amount of silence, and no one's talking about it, no one's even investigating. So
yeah,
I personally believe that Israel, of course, they have nuclear. I mean, even Netanyahu, when he was once asked live on TV, and he didn't even deny it. He said, "I'm not gonna say yes. I'm not gonna say no."
Right.
He didn't even say no.
There was an explosion actually a few days ago at an Israeli rocket factory, and there was also an Iranian newspaper recently talking about hitting the Dimona nuclear facility in response to Natanz. Is there any correlation between these incidents? Or do you think at the very least that it's keeping the Israelis on their toes?
Well, basically, of course, it's keeping the Israelis on their toes, but there's nothing confirmed yet if it's Iran. I mean, the Iranian media, they're always going to use anything to push their basically responses to Israel media response towards Israel. But even if Iran was responsible for this attack, if it's going to happen from the Syrian territories, and it's going to come with the authorization of the Syrian government. So for me, this act is both Syrian and Iranian, if it was actually Iranian attack, because in international law, Syria has every right to defend itself against Israeli continuous aggressions. The past 3 years alone, Israel bombed Damascus more than 500 times, and Israel continues to support Al-Qaeda on the borders of the occupied Golan. And in 2017, they helped Al-Qaeda enter the Golan, Israeli-occupied Golan, to attack a Syrian village on the other side where the Syrian army was trying to control that region. And, of course, Israel is also responsible for looting a lot of Jewish artifacts from the Jobar synagogue near Ghouta area. And a lot of investigations showed that those took those artifacts and they sent them to New York City via Qatar, and Israel had them all right now in Tel Aviv. So all that is happening, and Syria, whatever Syria does, they have the right to self-defense, just like they did in 2018 when they shot down an Israeli F-16.
I haven't seen anyone in the media even begin to question what Israel was doing in Syria in the first place. Why is that?
Basically, the media is trying to shy away the Washington camp. Whoever is on Washington's camp in Syria, they're trying just to hide whatever they're doing because they don't want to embarrass their foreign policy, or they want to embarrass the regime change agenda in Syria. So you're talking about the same media that called the bombing of 200 children in Aleppo in 2017. They called it a hiccup just because those children come from loyalist villages. They're not going to show the truth of what's happening. And definitely, even though Israel is not hiding the fact they're supporting Al-Qaeda, former Mossad, head of Mossad, told Al Jazeera that, yes, we're helping Al-Qaeda, but we're not actually going to help Hezbollah if the same scenario happened. He didn't lie. He just said what's happening, and yet the media's choosing to cover for them and choosing to hide the fact that Israel is not defending itself in Syria. They're helping a global terrorist organization in Syria against the Syrian people, against this legitimate Syrian government. So when Syria retaliates, then because the media keep hiding the Israeli action in Syria, the people won't know that Syria has every right to actually defend itself against Israel. So I think that's what they're doing, because they know one day Syria is going to retaliate, and then they don't want people to have enough content to actually justify for Syria.
Is it going to change their behavior when they attack Syria? Because, you know, as you just mentioned, as we know, they do this almost every week. So do you think that this kind of was a wake-up call?
I was asked that question when Syria downed an F-16, an Israeli F-16, and I said, I'm going to say the same thing right now. No, it's not going to affect it, because Israel is never going to stop aggressing Syria as long as it sees Syria winning. Let's put it that way. As long as Syria is winning, Israel is going to keep getting involved, giving logistic support for any terrorist organization that's happening. And I believe, okay, the attacks might just slow down those few days, but they're not going to stop. They're going to come back, and they're going to keep attacking until there's enough retaliation against the state. And for me, things will escalate more. Israel is trying to drag the region into a war. They're trying to drag the U.S. administration into war. They're trying to provoke any side they can. And the Axis of Resistance, they stated more than one time that they won't be dragged into an Israeli provocation.
So let me ask you then, what do you think it's going to take for Israel to stop?
A full-on Syrian victory against the global terrorist organizations. That's, as long as there are terrorists controlling Syria, Israel won't stop helping the last one against what Israel believes a threat to its existence.
Hadi Nasrallah, thank you so much for your brilliant analysis and insight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Richard. It was nice seeing you.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Now, the S-200 surface-to-air missile, also known as the SA-5, is an anti-aircraft missile developed by Russia in the 1960s. It has a maximum range of up to 300 kilometers and carries with it a 200-kilogram warhead. Indeed, what has everyone quite perplexed is how this S-200 exactly made the entire journey from Syria to Dimona, seemingly without being shot down by Israel, which, again, boasts one of the most capable air and missile defense systems, which is subsidized by the United States. Joining me is veteran war correspondent and journalist Elijah Manier. Thanks for coming on the program. Elijah, it's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
So Elijah, this incident that we just saw unfold at Dimona, it comes, again, less than 2 weeks after Israel sabotaged the Natanz nuclear enrichment facility in Iran. I think the question that is burning on everyone's minds at the moment is, are these two incidents related in any capacity? You know, is this perhaps retaliation for what just took place? What are your thoughts on that?
There are two points here to mention. The first one is the most important one, is that the Israeli interception system has failed, and it has dramatically failed, and that is the most important. If a missile can cross the whole territory and reach to Dimona 200 kilometers, 170 kilometers in depth, that is a real scandal and a revelation to how unprepared the Israeli interception missiles are, notwithstanding the whole noise that the Israelis are making about the effectiveness of the interception missiles, where they have dramatically failed. The second one, it is something that is good for the audience to know, that we have seen this happening before. In Yemen, the Houthis have used this kind of missiles and have removed a small piece in the missile that is called the self-destruction. So the surface-to-air missiles are made in a way that they explode in the air if they do not reach a target. So they fall in pieces and do not hurt civilians when they fall. And the Houthi, they have used this kind of missiles by removing this self-destruction and allowing the missile to take the maximum range and then fall like any other rocket. However, we have seen in the photos shown by the Israelis that this missile that fell in close to Dimona has a brain. And when I say has a brain, it means it has an electronic circuit. And by having this kind of brain, it means it can intercept a jet, it can intercept the target, it can be directed towards a specific target. Now, there's another point, and that's my last point as an answer to your question, is it is very convenient for President Bashar al-Assad to say nothing about it. So it is an errant missile, if the Israeli want to think like that. It can be some technical failure, and it went on its normal course, but accidentally it has reached close to Dimona, the nuclear facility that is clandestine to the world, where inspectors cannot go there and tell us what the Israelis are doing.
Yeah, so the Yemeni version that you just mentioned, it immediately made me think of the V1 doodle bug that the Germans developed during World War II, which would explode on impact. So, you know, as you mentioned, we saw pictures of the Israelis picking up pieces of this S-200. If you don't mind getting a bit more technical, you know, Israel boasts that it has this very comprehensive air defense system. They have the Iron Dome, David Sling, Arrow 123. You know, how does this supposedly antiquated S-200 from the Cold War get so deep inside of enemy territory? Do you get a sense that the Israelis are trying to downplay the incident and they know more than they're letting on?
Well, that's a very good question. The Israeli media is not going easy on Netanyahu and on the Israeli defense system. They're saying that Netanyahu was sleeping during his shift. He did not wake up to protect the country, that all the interception system we have is a failure. And in a month's time, Israelis have a maneuver on how to confront several fronts in different countries and all firing missiles at the same time. I think there is an overestimation of the Israeli defensive system, because it is very normal for the axis of the resistance to flood whatever capable the Israeli interception system is, including the U.S. interception system, that both showed a clear failure in intercepting the Houthi Yemeni missiles launched against Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, there are not only the U.S. and the Israeli, but also the British interception system, and all three systems failed to intercept the Houthi missiles fired from Yemen and the Houthi drones. So the Israeli, when they want to overestimate their capability, they go to 90%, which is extremely highly estimated and is not even close to the reality. And if we say 50-50, it means that Israel is in deep trouble in case of war. This is why Israel is not going to war, not against Syria, not against Lebanon, not against Iraq, and is extremely afraid that today the other side, on the other side of the border, is much more better equipped than it used to be in 2006. And today Israel cannot just think of doing a promenade over the Lebanese airspace or the Syrian airspace and get away with it.
Right, because you know the Israelis, they've done thousands of airstrikes in the last decade alone on Syria. And you know, 2 weeks ago we saw that Syria responded to an Israeli aggression over Lebanese airspace. Now we see this over Palestinian airspace. Do you think this is going to make future raids by the Israelis more difficult? Do you feel that last night a message has been sent?
I think the last night is a message from both governments. It is from the government in Damascus and the government in Tehran. And I think the government in Damascus is not willing to go to war with Israel. The Russian want to avoid this escalation, because still the war in Syria is not over. We still have Idlib, and we still have the pro-US forces in the northeast Syria. And we still have the borders between Iraq and Syria on the Tanf occupied by the US occupation forces. This is why the Russians are saying to the Syrian government, we can give you all the interception missile that you want. We try to put pressure on the Israelis. We are informed, and the Russians are informing the Syrian and the Iranians before the any attack takes place. However, this is not sufficient. The Syria, because of the economic sanction on the country, EU-US, because of the Caesar Act that Iran is violating, quite often by sending, so far, only last month they've sent 3 million barrels of oil. But because of all that, I don't think President Assad is willing to go to war with Israel right at the moment. However, this message from Iran is very helpful to put back Netanyahu in its place and tell him that if we want to retaliate, when we want to retaliate, we're going to use our means, including our allies' precision weapons, because Iran has delivered to Syria hundreds of precision weapons that they can make Israel tremble. The decision lies in the hand of the President Assad, and it's up to him to decide when to impose deterrence on the Israelis. But the Israelis are waiting for that day, and they know it's going to come.
Elijah Manier, thank you so much for your proficient and technical insight. It's a pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
Following the incident, Syria rebuked the Israeli attack and called on the United Nations Security Council to condemn Israel for violating the Agreement on Disengagement of 1974 and to uphold the mandates of UN Security Council Resolutions 242, 338, 350, and 497, which call on Israel to withdraw from the Syrian Golan Heights, which it invaded in 1967. Israel has been illegally occupying the Golan Heights since 1967 and even proceeded to annex them. Israel uses the Syrian Golan Heights, which are not only rich in oil and water and other resources, but also an important strategic and military point. It uses them to stage air raids and attacks on a regular basis in and around the Golan Heights in Syria. Israel bombs Syria on a regular basis, and it's not an exaggeration. This is actually happening almost every single week. Israel doesn't typically comment on these raids, but has previously admitted to them and admitted to bombing Syria hundreds of times. And that was back in 2018. We're in 2021. This figure is now in the thousands. You know, Israel knows that Syria is going through a war. There are a dozen plus countries and many more factions ripping the country apart. So Israel takes advantage of that to apply pressure from the south. Israel's former chief of Mossad has even admitted in an interview with Mehdi Hassan on Al Jazeera that Israel gave aid and assistance to Al-Qaeda fighters just for the sake of seeing the Syrian government fall. So this should give you some indication, some idea as to how determined the Israelis are to attack Syria. Israel bombs Syria under the pretext of targeting so-called Iranian militias or Hezbollah. But number one, this is unverified. Again, Israel says this, but no one corroborates it. There's no evidence of that. Number two, and more importantly, this is still a violation of international law and the United Nations Charter to attack a sovereign country. Just because Israel says it's doing XYZ doesn't make that legal, right? This is not self-defense, nor is it permitted or mandated by the United Nations Security Council. Even if this were true, that there are Iranian or other troops inside of Syria, that's not Israel's business, that's Syria's business. Syria is a sovereign, independent country. It has the right to have alliances with whomever it wishes. The United States has over 800 bases in other countries. Has the mainstream media ever checked to see if these claims by Israel are true? Has it ever verified them? Has the media ever even said that this is a violation of international law and criticized Israel for that? The media only seems to repeat these claims by Israel, which is propaganda, and they report it as fact with no scrutiny whatsoever. Again, that's not reporting, that's propaganda. In addition to these bombings by Israel, which happen almost every week, Israel continues to occupy the Syrian Golan Heights illegally and has outright said it will never relinquish them. Benny Gantz has said Israel will never withdraw. even though this is a violation of multiple UN Security Council resolutions, which were unanimously passed by everyone at the time, including the United States. You know, it seems that Israel, unfortunately, has no respect for Iran's sovereignty, for Syria's sovereignty, and definitely not for Palestinian sovereignty. Israel does not respect the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which it has not signed, nor the Chemical Weapons Convention. Israel violates the United Nations Charter practically every single week, if not every day. You know, perhaps if the international community will not put its foot down and restrain Israel from conducting illegal strikes and raids and committing acts of war almost every other day against Syria, then hopefully what just took place will deter the Israelis and make them think twice before they launch unprovoked attacks on Syria and violate its independence and sovereignty. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.